The Midrash tells us that Hashem asked the Malachim permission, Nase Adam, let us make man, Bitzalminu Kidmosenu. The Malachi Ashoris, who were being treated to this tremendous show of honor, said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Matibu, what is the nature of this man that you wish to create? Says Hashem to the Malachim, Chachmoso Meruba Mishalachem. His wisdom, his intelligence is greater than yours. And then the Midrash tells us that after Hashem created Adam, Hashem showed the Malachim exactly what Kaviyocha, what Hashem meant. Hashem asked the Malachim, name the animals. But he wasn't asking them to just give a title, a phrase to the animals. In our languages, we use certain labels by convention. We call an object that's flat with legs a table. Not that there's any direct definition of that object through the word table, but by convenience, by convention, that's the label that we use for it. But what Hashem was saying to the Malachim was, I want you to define the essence, the nature, the inner being of this animal. Use one phrase to define it and give it a very clear definition. And the Malachim could not do it. They were holy, they were pure, they were brilliant, but that was a wisdom of which they were incapable of doing. And then Hashem said to Adam, name the animals. And each one Adam named flawlessly. Ze chamor, ze shor, ze gamal. This is a cow, this is a donkey. Each one he defined the essence, defined the inner nature of the being, its natural inclinations and desires, and gave it one title in one fell swoop, defined it. At which point the Malachim were awed by his wisdom and they understood exactly what Hashem meant. But Adam didn't stop there. He then gave a name to himself and then he gave a name to his wife. And there's an interruption in the Chumash. And the Rashi explains that when the Pasuk says, Vayikra Adam Shem Ishto Chava, when man gave a name to his wife, it was immediately after naming the animals and he called his wife Chava. Why did he call his wife Chava? Kihi Haisa Im Kochai. Because she was the mother of all future human beings, the progenitor of the human race. Through her were to come humanity. And the question is, what does Chava mean? What does the expression mean? What does it refer to? And the Baal HaTurim explains. He says, Chava Al Shem Shem Chava, because she speaks. Adam called his wife talker, speaker. And in fact, the Baal HaTurim goes on to say, and that's what the Gemara in Kedushim says, Yud Kavim Sichi Yardu La'olam. There were 10 measures of speech that came into the world. Tisha Notlu Noshim. Women took 9. 9 measures of speech women took, and 1/10 men took. And this is the concept that women speak more than do men. And this Baal HaTurim is quite difficult to understand. What the Baal HaTurim is saying is that Adam defined the essence of his wife as talker. Now, number one, it doesn't sound very respectful. Talker. Doesn't sound like a very nice way to refer to your wife. But more telling, it sounds to be irrelevant. She is the mother of humanity. She is the mother of all future human beings. And because of that, Adam gave her the name talker. Number one, talker doesn't define her essence. It may be an element. It may be true that women tend to speak more than men. But that's not the essence. It doesn't define her. And not only doesn't it define her, but it's surely not the criteria via which she is the mother of future generations. The Pasuk is saying this is what he called her because this is the ingredient that makes her the mother of humanity. Even if you tell me it's part of her nature, it's surely not the reason why she became the mother of future generations. And this Baal HaTurim is very difficult to understand. And I'd like to see if we can understand this. And to do that, I think we need to take a little bit of a tour of this thing called the human being. And to do that, let's start with an interesting observation. Many young fellow, when preparing to get married, read a pasuk in Chumash with great joy. Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Hashem says, Lo tov yos adam levado, it's not good for man to be alone, Eselo Ezek Kenegdo, I'll make for him a helpmate. So many young fellows preparing for marriage say, wow, an Ezer helpmate, this is going to be great. A Polynesian maidservant at my beck and call. My every wish is her command. This thing called marriage is going to be wonderful. And then he gets married and he discovers that, that it ain't quite so. And the reason why it ain't quite so is because the Maral explains that he missed half of the definition. The Maral on Rashi on this pasuk explains that the Torah says, Eselo Ezer Kenegdo, I'm going to make a helpmate Kenegdo. What does Kenegdo mean? It translates loosely as opposite. But the Maral explains that opposite can have two divergent meanings. Opposite can mean, quite simply, opposite as in facing, as in the Klai Yisrael were chonu neged ahar. They camped opposite, facing the mountain. Opposite could have the sense of facing. Explains the Maral that that, in fact, is one of the meanings of the pasuk. When Hashem says, I'm going to make an Ezer Kenegdo, it means a helpmate opposite him. Explains the Maral facing him, meaning to say, Ki ha'ishi chashuva v'shkula kamo ha'ish, that the woman is as chashuv, as important, v'shkula, and equal to the man. Meaning to say she is a helpmate on his level, opposite him, facing him, as important as him, as significant as him. Meaning to say, not subservient, not submissive, not second rate, equal and as important. They're two equal partners in this marriage. And as an aside, throughout the millennium of human history, this is not the way typically women were looked at. In fact, within the past 300 years, there's been a tremendous movement for women's equality because, in fact, women were treated as second-class or third-class citizens without rights, without any real consideration for their needs, and etc. But I'd like to point out that from a Torah perspective, in a Torah marriage, there never was a need for a women's equality movement because in a Torah marriage, the woman is an equal partner. Two equal partners in this marriage. And as the Maral explains, chashuv v'shokul, as important and equal to the man. And that is one definition of the word opposite kenegdo, but explains the Maral that there's another meaning. The word opposite could also mean the antithesis, as in the reverse, dissimilar, unlike, as in, let's play the opposite game. Let's imagine for a minute I say a word and I ask you, what's the opposite? So if I say the word black and I ask you, what's the opposite? You'll say white. In, opposite of in is out. Up, the opposite of up is down. Male, the opposite of male is female. As in they are completely, totally different. It's not like men and women are mostly alike, but there's certain differences. They are absolutely conflicting, opposites, unalike, dissimilar, totally disparate. Explains Maral that that is the second definition of the word kenegdo, and it also holds true. Explains the Maral, ki azachar v'nekeva im shnei hapchim. The male and the female are two opposites. They are totally different in nature, in temperament, and totally different in the way they do things, totally different in the way they approach things and the way they think. And therefore explains the Maral, that's exactly what Rashi means when he says that when Hashem is in the marriage, then the Ish and the Isha are complete, they live in peace. Because by nature, man and woman should never be able to live in peace. Because they're so opposite, so divergent in nature, they should be at war one with the other. When Hashem is in the marriage, Hashem makes shalom, Hashem brings the two opposites together, and there's peace. But when Hashem is not in the marriage, when Hashem is out of the marriage, then what happens is they're Eish, one fire that eats another fire, they're two warring parties. And explains the Maral, that's exactly what Rashi means when he says, Zochan the Keva Ish v'Isha, the Hay of Eish and the Yud of Eish. When you keep Hashem in it, it's peace. If not, the reason why it's one fire that eats another fire is because by nature, by temperament, by inclination, they are opposite. And explains the morale that both of these meanings are true. Both of these meanings are the definition of Ezer Kenegdo, a helpmate opposite him. Equal partners, but opposite with different roles. And to focus on what that means, that they are equal partners but different roles, let's focus for a minute on the different roles of man and woman. And to do that, let's look at a pasuk in the Chumash. When the Jewish nation were in Mitzrayim, the Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, oppressed the Jewish people. But it wasn't just that they made them work hard. It wasn't just that they made their life difficult. As kol avodasam asher avdu ben befarech, the Egyptians attempted to oppress the Jewish people with the work. Everything that they did was to destroy their character, destroy their matzav ruach, their attitude. And the very labor that they gave them was oppressive. And the Gemara explains to us, what does it mean that it was befarech, that the labor that they gave them was oppressive? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, shemachalfim meleches anoshim lenoshim. They switched the roles. They gave the women the jobs normally allocated to men, and they gave the men the jobs that normally were given to women. And that's what it means, that they oppressed them. They wouldn't even let them work at the roles that they normally did. They gave the men the women's jobs, and the ladies the men's job. And Friedlander asks a very interesting question on this Gemara. I understand that the men had very difficult work. You can imagine backbreaking labor, lifting heavy stones, chiseling rock, standing all day in the hot sun, cementing bricks. I understand why if you give that type of work to a woman, it's oppressive. It doesn't suit her nature, doesn't suit her physicality. And I understand why that would be oppressive to give the women the work that's normally allocated to men. But the opposite should not be true. Imagine you take a big, strong man and give him the job that's normally given to a woman. Normally, the work of a woman is to cook, to clean, iron, taking care of children. Taking a big, strong man who's used to lifting the heavy stones, used to standing in the field all day cementing, this should be a cakewalk. This is a vacation. It shouldn't be oppressive. Quite the opposite. It should be wonderful for him. Why was it oppressive? And explains to Friedlander that that is the nature of man and the nature of woman. When Hashem created each, Hashem gave them a different teva, a different nature, different inclinations. And Hashem gave them the nature that suits the work that they are supposed to be doing. A woman has a nature for a certain kind of work. A man has a nature for a certain kind of work. And even if you give a man work that's physically not difficult, if it doesn't suit his nature, there's a discontentment, there's a disharmony. He doesn't feel satisfied with the work. He's not well suited for it. It's not well suited for him. And even if he could accomplish it, even if he could do it, it's oppressive. Why? Because he's not suited for it by temperament, by nature, and it doesn't fit him. And this concept is what the morale is telling us. Ezer Kenegdo means two definitions, equal partners. The woman is not second class. She's not on a different level. She is chashuv as the man and shakul. She is equal, but they are opposite. They're very different. Equal partners with different roles. And this understanding is key and fundamental to understanding how a marriage should function. A woman's role in the marriage is the akeres habayis, the main support of the house. To cultivate, to nurture, to support, to care for the relationships in the house, to be a wife, to be a mother, that is her role. And some people make a mistake. They think that that means she's the cook, the cleaner, the one who, the domestic help. And I'd like to share with you that while that oftentimes becomes a part, it's but a very small part of the role of a woman in the house. When my kids were little, I used to say to my wife all the time, we have to buy as much cleaning help as we can. We have to buy as much takeout food for Shabbos as we can. And I remember my wife saying, but what do you mean? You don't want me to bake challahs for Shabbos? Isn't that holy? And I would say to her that right now our kids are little. What our family needs is for you to be on the floor with them playing. They need your time. They need your attention. The kids will grow up, Yimit Hashem. Then you'll have plenty of time. You could bake challahs. But right now, the primary role that you, as part of our family, as a support, is to be the one to give attention to our children, to be there for them, to be involved in their life, to nurture them, to give them what they need. And I'd like to share with you, last year I was in South Africa, and because of the situation there, help in the home is very, very inexpensive. Almost every frum house has at least two full-time live-in domestic aides to cook, to clean, to take care of everything. I remember I went to shul in the morning, and when I came back, the shirt that I'd worn the day before was cleaned and pressed. The women there, by and large, do not have to clean. They don't have to take care of laundry. They don't have to cook. So you may say, what do they do? Obviously, they can't be mothers. They can't be wives because that's the main job, right? So what do? I'd like to share with you what they do. And what they do is they nurture, they support, they bring up the children. They're involved in the children's life because the main role of the Akeres HaBayis is not to be the cook and the cleaning person. Again, in most situations, that's a part. But the main role of the woman is to be the one who nurtures, supports, who cares, who's involved in the child's needs, in the husband's emotional needs. And that's the Akeres HaBayis. And as an example of this, I'd like to share with you an interesting fact. It was somewhere in the early 1950s, Harry Harlow was a psychologist who was doing a study on learning in monkeys. Now, the problem was that much was unknown about the very nature of learning. So to study how, in fact, primates learn, he began doing experiments on various monkeys. And the problem was that he couldn't get enough monkeys to experiment on, so he began breeding them himself. And what he discovered was that it was far more efficient that when the mother monkey would give birth, he would take the baby monkeys and put them in isolated cells, and he would provide the food and nourishment that he needed. But it was much more efficient to breed a colony of monkeys. That way, without having the mothers around, he could then more quickly bring the next generation. And what he did was he discovered something that was absolutely eye-opening to scientists at the time. You see, the monkeys that he had brought up in isolation, although they were well cared for, they were well fed, and their needs were taken care of, became abnormal. They couldn't socialize, they couldn't learn, they couldn't function as a regular monkey would. What was lacking wasn't the food, what was lacking wasn't the bodily needs. What was lacking was the mother's love and attention. And these monkeys that were brought up in isolation were abnormal, weren't able to function. And what Harlow presented to the world was scientific evidence that the role of the mother as caregiver, as nurturer, was essential for the psychological, emotional health of the monkey. And the reason why this was so eye-opening was because this was the early 1950s. And in the early 1950s, there was a huge argument amongst social scientists, amongst psychologists, what in fact was the role of the mother and whether in fact she was needed. B.F. Skinner, who was a behaviorist, had posited that the role of the mother was strictly to be the one to provide food, to provide maybe clothing and warmth, but that nurturing bond wasn't needed. And this had become accepted as scientific fact in most settings. As a matter of fact, in most hospitals, if they took an infant in, they would separate the infant from human contact. The mother certainly wasn't allowed in, and other human contact wasn't allowed in. In many orphanages, they would just bring up the babies effectively in isolation. They would care for them in the sense that they would provide food, but the idea of coddling, the idea of holding, was not considered of any significance. As a matter of fact, early literature of the late 1940s, 1950s, scientific literature presented the fact that if you're a good mother, a good father, do not coddle your baby. When the baby cries, leave it there. What you're doing by picking up the baby is spoiling it. The baby needs milk. The baby needs to be changed. The baby needs to be clothed, but anything beyond that is damaging to the child, because what you're doing is you're pampering it, and you're giving it attention that it doesn't need, and you're hurting the child. And many a well-intentioned mother who read the various magazines or maybe even scientific journals that were coming out at the time did exactly that. She resisted the urge to pick up her child, to cuddle, to just spend time nurturing the child, because scientific evidence held it to be obvious that that damages the child. And when Harlow came out with his experimentation and his new findings, he began opening up a new understanding in psychology's version of the human and the role of the mother. Now, obviously, it's accepted as common wisdom that if the mother isn't there to nurture the child, to be with the child, to hold the child, to, at the early stages, even just to coo and make noises with the child, it damages the child. And modern science has now come to understand that the role of the mother is not the one to provide the milk, the clothing, and the basic needs. The main role of the mother is to be the caregiver in the sense of nurturing, that the child should feel secure and loved, that the bond between mother and child is not merely one of providing physical needs, but much more so to provide the emotional attachment, to provide its security, and the child needs to be nurtured, needs to be supported, needs to be loved. And while science didn't understand this for decades, this is the nature of the woman, and it is the role of the mother. And if you'd like to understand at a very deep level what the role of a woman is, it's to be the one involved in the relationships of the family, to be the caregiver in the sense of emotionally involved, to be the one who nurtures her children, who nurtures the relationship with her husband. She is, in a certain level, what we would call almost the relationship manager of the family. And to allow for that, Hashem gave her a very unique teva, a very unique nature different than a man. And if you'd like to see an illustration of this, I'll share with you an obvious thought. When my daughter, Soralea, was in 11th grade, she was in high school and she came home one day and we were talking and she said that two of her friends didn't come to school that day. I said, oh, why? She explained to me that they were having a DMC. They stayed up late last night having a DMC, so they didn't come to school that day. And I said, what's a DMC? And she said, oh, you don't know? At this point, I was a little nervous. No, what is a DMC? She explained to me, a DMC is a deep, meaningful conversation. They had a deep, meaningful conversation. They were on the phone until 3 o'clock in the morning. They were too tired. They didn't come to school the next day. I taught high school boys for 15 years. I never once saw two guys involved in sharing their emotions, sharing their feelings for hours after hours, emoting together. It doesn't happen. In a guy's world, that type of sharing, that type of emotional connection almost never happens. In a girl's world, it's very common. Girls, by nature, seek out relationships. You could see it at the youngest age. Watch 6-year-old girls on the playground. You'll see they always either have a best friend or are sort of looking to create that relationship. They're very much relationship-based. In fact, one of the big things about little girls when they're 6 or 7 is keeping a secret, because a secret means that you and I have a special relationship. And I can trust you if you keep the secret. If you give up the secret, let others know that I can't trust you, and likely your new best friend is gone. But you see, it's within the very nature of a woman to seek out relationships, to need the relationships, because that is the teva, that is the way that Hashem created the woman. Much more than a man, a woman almost rates herself on how many meaningful and significant relationships she has. If she has a number of good, solid relationships where she is nurturing and she feels nurtured, she feels good about herself. And if she doesn't, likely she doesn't feel as good about herself. And that is the nature of a woman. That is the way that Hashem created the woman. Now, if you ask this question, what is the way that we human beings create relationships, maintain them, develop them, and nurture them? There's really only one way. It's through conversation. The main vehicle via which we human beings create social connections is by speaking. Speech and communication is the way that we create social connections, the way we maintain them, the way we develop them. And if you'd like to understand why it is that a woman speaks more than a man, it's because Hashem gave her a nature to be the one to seek out, maintain, repair, and build relationships. And I believe that's exactly the answer to the Baal Turim. Do you know why Adam called his wife Chava? Not because she's chatty. Women aren't more chatty than men, just casually, just happens to be that way. The reason why Hashem gave more of a talker nature to a woman than to a man is because Hashem gave them a nature to create relationships, to build them, and to maintain them. And the way that we human beings build relationships is by speaking. A woman has a need to speak, need to talk, because she has a need to build relationships. She needs to share. She needs to care. She needs to express her emotions and feel other people's emotions, because that's the way we human beings build connections. That is the way we human beings build relationships. It's because she is the mother of all future generations. That is why Hashem gave her that nature, because that's what's needed to be a mother and to be the one responsible for the relationship, responsible for the children, responsible for their emotional, psychological health, to be the one to be the relationship manager, the one to connect. And that is why Adam called his wife talker, not casually and certainly not in a derogatory nature, but because Hashem gave her that teva, that inclination, because she is the one who builds the relationships in the house. And it's very interesting when you see this manifest in the different ways that men and women speak. Men and women, not only do they speak differently, they speak for completely different reasons. You'll ever notice, you could find on a very regular basis in a family, sisters will be very good friends. You have two sisters who are very close. Sometimes you could have guys, brothers, who are also buddies. But it's very rare to have a brother and a sister who are very, very close. I mean, they could be, you know, fond of each other, but to have a brother and a sister that are very close isn't that common. And you know why? Because, again, it's not just that men and women speak about different things. They speak often for totally different reasons. Very often, the reason why a woman speaks is to share her emotions, to join together with another human being. The reason, generally speaking, why men talk is to share information. When one guy talks to another guy, he's telling him stuff. He may be talking about politics or sports or ideas or concepts, but it's to convey information. And one of the great disparities between men and women, and one of the reasons why oftentimes relationships are difficult, is because they each speak for different reasons, give over different information, and oftentimes neither one understands why the other is doing it. And oftentimes, when you listen to women speak, men have the attitude that they're talking about the most irrelevant trivia. People and occurrences, what happened, what she said, and what he said, and what does it matter? In an objective sense, he is correct. It doesn't matter. It's not earth-shattering. It's not world-shaping. But you know why she's doing it? She's doing it not to convey the information. She's doing it to build a relationship. She is sharing. She's expressing. She expects that back. And that's how women speak. If you listen in, if you go Shabbos afternoon to a house and you'll hear the men speaking in one room, the women speaking in another, you'll hear they're speaking in totally different ways. Again, not just the words, not just the concepts, but why they speak. And the result is what they speak about, certainly. And the result is that they communicate in vastly different ways. And one of the great secrets to be successfully married is you have to understand how your spouse communicates and why they communicate. But before we focus on that, I'd like to take one more step that I think is very important. For 300 years now in Western civilization, there has been a movement for women's liberation. The first few hundred years of it, again, much of it was justified and proper. initially women didn't have the right to own land, they didn't have a right to vote, they didn't even have, they had very few rights at all. Basically, they were treated as chattel, as second-class citizens, something that you owned, you bought, you sold, you had a daughter, you sold her, you bought a wife. And in a very real sense, they were treated in a way that certainly the Torah would consider inappropriate, and much of the initial women's liberation movement was appropriate, was proper. Because, in fact, they were treated not with equality, but the exact opposite. But in the late 50s and early 60s in America, something else came about. It's what's known as the second wave of the women's liberation movement, a totally different agenda, a totally different focus. You see, already they had the right to own land. Women had the right to vote. They had effectively all rights as men did. Granted, in the marketplace, they wouldn't earn the same wage, often for the same job, but equality in roles was basically there. But what was being pushed for was something very, very different. And one of the seminal books of the era was a book that was written in the 1950s. It was written by a woman, Betty Friedan, and it's called The Feminine Mystique. And she opens up by describing that she was a writer for a women's magazine. And when she started writing this book that she wrote, she sort of felt there was a problem. It didn't have a name, wasn't even really identified. But the more she wrote about it and the more she focused on it, the more that she saw it was everywhere. Wherever she turned, wherever she looked, this problem that had no name, that couldn't even be identified, was looming large. Now, you have to understand, she wrote, published a book in 1963. It was about the past 10 years in the United States of America. The 50s in America were happy days. The World War II was over. The vets had come back. They, by and large, they married, bought homes in the suburbs, began their next generation. They had their kids. And in the American culture, the woman's role was to be the wife and the mother. Any girl going to school for university studies really was very cautious because her main role in life was to be a mother, was to be a wife, and she didn't want to lose that identity. And Betty Friedan was speaking to a generation that was clearly defined, where each gender knew their role very, very clearly. Men went to work, women were the housewives, were the mothers of children. And what she defined was a problem that had no name, but she said that basically all of these women, millions of them, were unfulfilled. Millions of women were unsatisfied, but they didn't even know it. Millions of women were sitting home and cleaning and cooking and taking care of the kids, and they didn't even realize how empty their lives were, how unfulfilled. And she began explaining, and women began joining in the bandwagon, and it became a very popular concept that the reason why women are unfulfilled is because they're unable to have a career that they really would be much better suited for, and they would enjoy much greater expansion, much greater fulfillment, much greater sense of self if they did it. And the women's liberation movement created exactly that, a revolution in gender identification, a revolution in the roles. And it became not just accepted, but it became common practice for women, of course, to have a career. In the early 1980s in America, if a woman was a homemaker and on the census she had to answer, what do? She was embarrassed, a homemaker. I mean, people looked at her, are you a primitive, a homemaker, just a homemaker? And millions of women left the home to go out and expand themselves and find themselves. And some 20 to 30 years later, what people found was that not only wasn't it the great panacea, not only wasn't the great solution, quite the opposite. I remember very clearly in that time period, 1980s, I was in yeshiva in Rochester, and I remember there was a daycare center nearby, which is effectively one of these drop-off centers. You know, you drop your kid early in the morning and pick them up late at night. We're talking almost like a kennel. I hate to use that expression, but almost a kennel for babies, because that's effectively what the mothers would do. They would drop their children off at 7:30 in the morning, pick them back up at 6 at night. And these women were running out for what? To be bank tellers, to be secretaries. They weren't pursuing scientific careers. They weren't pursuing academia. but it became such a concept in the world that the only way a woman can be fulfilled is if she has a career, that it became brainwashed within the world, and in fact, it became something that was an accepted common practice. And I'd like to share with you how extreme it was. In her book, Betty Friedan writes, "The traditional homes where wives were not employed are as comfortable as concentration camps." And in fact, the radical feminism got more extreme. They began calling marriage an oppressive institution that harms women and children. Various essays came out. It became increasingly clear the institution of marriage protects women in the same way that the institution of slavery was said to protect blacks. Since marriage constitutes slavery for women, the women's movement must concentrate on attacking this institution. On and on, you had entire movements and entire cadres of people writing on every level and putting out to the public the idea that this is the only way that a woman can find fulfillment, that she can find happiness. And it got to a very interesting point when the entire focus was that women should be allowed to do men's jobs. As in, why is it that a woman can't be a policeman? Why is it that a woman can't be a fireman? Now, the fact that a fireman has to carry a very heavy body up and down a ladder, and many women are not physically suited for that, had to be something that has to be irrelevant, and we have to figure out a solution. And what feminism did, unfortunately, was misunderstand the gender difference, and what they effectively did was masculinize the woman. It's not feminism, it's masculinism. And what they don't understand is exactly what this morale is sharing with us. And that is that the nature of a woman is different than the nature of a man. Are there women who are intellectual? 100%. Are there women who are brilliant? Are there women who should have a career? No question about it. And many women, even as great mothers, do better part-time out of the house. But the role of a woman, her nature, her essence, is to be the Akeres HaBayis, to be the wife, to be the mother. And the social revolution of the 60s damaged mankind's understanding of the role of a man and the role of a woman. Now, unfortunately, in our current economic situation, in most families, it happens to be that women have to work. That's just the reality of needing to pay bills. But the basic understanding is that the role of a woman is to be the Akeres HaBayis, to be the mother, to be the wife, to be the caregiver in the home, to take care of the home. The role of the man is to be the one who earns a living. It's true that right now, in a sense, we, the Jewish nation, benefit in the sense that we have a kolel system, probably only because of women's liberation. If it weren't for that, it probably would not be socially acceptable for women to be outside the home working, supporting their husbands. And it is certainly appropriate for a short time in the beginning of a marriage for there to be such a relationship, and in some rare situations, even longer. But understanding that the role of the woman is to be the Akeres HaBayis, the role of the man is to be the breadwinner, the supporter. Each have their role. Each are equal in the marriage, but equal partners with very, very different roles. And while this is important on a philosophical level, it becomes far more important on an actual relationship level. And if you'd like to understand one of the reasons why marriages are very, very difficult today, and why relationships in a marriage are very strained, one of the reasons has to do with exactly this mistake. Because we've lost the difference between gender, because men and women are viewed basically the same, when a couple gets married, they don't even recognize that he and she are so vastly different that they forget to take that into account when they're building the relationship. As an example, if you ask marriage therapists, what is the most common claim that they hear? Over and over, marriage therapists report the most frequently expressed complaint that women have about men is that they never listen. And amazingly, all men complain about is that all women want to do is talk. So it's a little strange, isn't it? Meaning the men are saying that all the women want to do is talk, and the women are saying that the men never listen. Now, if one is talking, the other one's listening, right? I mean, isn't it obvious? And it's almost comical to hear the wife say, I talk to you and you don't listen. And the husband says, yes, I do. And he'll say back for her word for word exactly what she says. And she'll say the words, right, you see, that proves you're not listening. So what's pshat? What is happening here? And I think what's happening here really is exactly this mistake that most of us make when we're beginning a marriage, and many of us make even long into the marriage, and that's misunderstanding the role of communication in a marriage, misunderstanding why each one will speak, and misunderstanding how significant communication is in a marriage. And to share with you exactly what I mean, I'll give you a mashal from my own life. This mistake I only realized probably 10 years into my marriage. Now, Baruch Hashem, we're happily married. We're now 26 years, and I'm very happily married, and even my wife is happily married. But there are, I don't care how successful your marriage is, there are issues, there are things that come up. And it took me 10 years to realize this mistake that I was making in my own marriage. I was a high school Rebbe, and oftentimes the guys would come with problems, with issues, and I would talk to them. And it would happen on a very regular basis. A guy would bring up a problem in his house, whether it be his parents, or maybe it's a roommate, or it's learning, whatever it would be. And I'd talk, and I'd listen, and we'd, you know, discuss things. And it almost always happened that the guy walked away very satisfied and felt that, you know, I presented to him a different way of looking at things, a different way of doing things. And guys came over regularly, and it was a very mutually satisfactory relationship. And I would go home, and the same thing would happen. My wife would come to me with her problems and issues, and every time I gave her my wise advice, not once was she satisfied. And it was the strangest thing. Guys would come to me with all types of problems, and I'd offer them advice, and invariably they were happy, and it worked. And my wife would come to me with the same sort of problems, and invariably she was never happy with my wisdom. And it was shocking. Until it dawned on me the why. As strange as it sounds, I didn't understand the basics of what she was doing. What my wife was doing was not coming to me for wise advice. She was coming to me with her day, with her problems, with her issues, to share them with her husband. She wanted to have a listening ear. And what she was listening for was just me to be there with her, to share it with her, to experience it with her, to feel it with her. And what she was hearing was the opposite. I wasn't listening. I wasn't getting emotionally involved. I wasn't empathizing with her. I was solving her problems. And it never once satisfied her because she wasn't looking for solutions. And as obvious as it may sound, it took me 10 years, and I'd like to share with you, it is one of the most common mistakes that spouses on both ends of the gender spectrum make. Meaning to say, husbands have to learn that when their wife is expressing something, she's expressing in a way different than a guy would. Guys don't come over typically to share their emotions and to unburden themselves and to share the day in that sense. Guys usually come over, if they're asking advice, it's because they're looking for a solution. But when a wife brings to you her day and a problem and an issue, she's not looking for solutions. She's looking to share it with you. She's looking to connect with you. She's looking to build an emotional bond. And you have to listen as a woman will listen. And this is shocking. Because it's not just that men and women speak differently. Men and women listen differently. Let's go back to a Shabbos afternoon in a regular home. Men in one room speaking, women in the other room speaking. And if you listen carefully, you'll see it's not just that the men speak differently than the women do. It's that on the receiving end, you'll hear all different types of responses. Let's play anthropologists. Let's imagine we didn't speak the language, but we've got to hear the two differences between the conversations. In the men's room, you would hear as follows. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. One guy speaks, and then silence. Then the guy continues. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Silence. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Silence. Go to the woman's room, and you hear a very different experience. The woman says, da-da-da-da-da, and you hear, da-da-da-da-da, uh-huh, da-da-da-da, oh, da-da-da. You see, there are listening noises that women make that men don't. Men will sit there and posit their information about whether it be science or sports or learning or whatever it may be, and the other fellow sits there and listens, oftentimes very, very carefully, and sometimes not so carefully, but generally speaking, it's rude to interrupt, so you listen. Let me hear what you're saying. And when you're done, I'll comment. But that's not the way women listen. The way women listen is a woman says something, And her friend says, oh. And the woman will make another statement, and her friend will say, ah. And the listening noises are very different. And the reason why it's essential to understand these differences are because this is one of the key areas of breakdown in communication. The Chazon Ish explains that the first year in a marriage is a time to build achdus, to build oneness. But the way you build oneness in the human relationship world is by communicating, by sharing. And you have to understand that a husband and wife share things differently, speak differently, and communicate differently. And that means a husband has to listen to his wife, understand that what she's looking to do in the conversation often is just share her concerns and her fears and her issues, and she's not looking for solutions. And a husband has to learn to be supportive of that, to say those words that she's looking to hear, as in, and whatever comes out in the normal course of emotionally connecting with another human being. And a woman as well has to understand that what she's normally accustomed to often won't be in this relationship. Most women get married with a sense of, it's going to be great. All my life I've had friends, good friends, sometimes the best friends, sometimes very good friends, but now it's going to be great. I'm going to have my best friend, the best friend, and he's going to be there all the time. And she starts just pouring it forth and explaining her day and sharing and caring. And she says, I don't ever need any of my girlfriends anymore. This is great because now I have a husband. Then that's even better. And she makes a big mistake. Because while it is important for a husband to learn to listen, it's also important for a woman to understand that girlfriends are different than her husband. And it's important to share with the husband, and it's important to relate to the husband, and it's important to communicate with your husband. But not everything, not every issue are you going to bring to your husband, because eventually you're going to wear his ear out. And while men have to learn to listen, to empathize, to relate, women have to learn that their need to emote oftentimes should be focused on the marriage because it builds a connection, but oftentimes should be done outside the marriage by keeping her girlfriends, keeping her people she speaks to, because men and women have different needs that need to be focused differently. And I believe that this understanding that the morale is sharing with us is fundamental. What the morale is saying to us is that the reason why Adam called his wife Chava is because that's the nature of the woman, to be a talker. Because she's chatty? No, not at all. But because Hashem gave her the nature that's needed to be the Akeras Abayis. What is the pillar of the home? The one who builds the climate, who builds the culture, who creates the relationships, who keeps everyone together. A mother to a child is the one who nurtures, who gives, who cares. And just like Lahavdil, excuse my dimyon, but just like a monkey, if you give the monkey the bottle and clothe it, it's going to be abnormal. Surely a human baby does not just need its needs met, it needs nurturing, it needs love, it needs caring, and even past 6 months, and even past 2 years. And the way we human beings build relationships is by communicating, by talking. Hashem gave the woman a nature to talk because that's the way we build relationships. Adam called his wife Chava because she is the mother of all future generations. And what a mother needs is the ability to build, foster, and maintain relationships. Communication is the system via which we do it. Husbands and wives both have to understand the imperativeness of this. One of the main jobs, as the Chazon Ish says, during the first year of marriage is to build a oneness, to build a connection, to build an attachment. There are many tools that Hashem gave us to do that with. One is simply infatuation. The other is romantic love and spending time in that way as couple. But this is a tool that bonds much, much deeper. And that is communicating, sharing, expressing, sharing your life, sharing your emotions. Women have to understand that men typically don't do that naturally. And when your husband doesn't share with you and doesn't relate to you, part of your role as a wife is to train him, to explain to him and help bring him out. Many guys can be very well formed, very wholesome, have lots of buddies, but never have a best friend. I remember very clearly asking Rabbi Harris, who's Rosh Shiva, when I was in second year base mentorship, and I said, I don't have a best friend. I don't know why. What's wrong? And he looked at me and said, I don't know anybody who has a best friend. Most guys don't have a best friend. They have friends, chaverim, your friend, you support, you talk. But the idea in a guy's world of having a best friend that you communicate with, that you share, that you're always speaking with, is rare. And a big part of the reason is because men don't build relationships because they have a need to communicate. When men communicate, it's to share ideas, to share concepts, and that doesn't build relationships. So a man has to understand that he has to learn to communicate. He has to learn to listen to his wife. He has to learn to be interested, genuinely interested, not because it's so important and not because the issue at discussion is so significant, but because it's her world. This is your wife. She's scared. She's afraid. She's happy. She's sad. Whatever it may be, you're experiencing her world with her. You're sharing her world, and that's how you bond. That's how you connect. A husband has to understand that he has to learn that, and a wife has to understand that part of her role is to teach that, because guys typically don't communicate that way, and she has to be patient and tolerant. She has to understand that not everything is to be shared with a husband all the time, because eventually you're going to chew his ear off, and you keep your girlfriends, and you speak to your friends, and whoever it may be, about the small issues. And you also have to train your husband how to listen, how to be involved, and you have to train him how to speak. He has to share his issues. He has to become vulnerable. He has to learn to communicate. And that's a big part of building the bond, a big part of connecting. I would like to close this session with one last observation. A chassan kala came over to my house, a shal shudas, and I got to see something that I almost made my jaw drop. Now, oftentimes, chassan kala will come before they're married. Sometimes they ask a question, sometimes for advice, sometimes just for a bracha. And I get to watch how they interact. And what I saw was absolutely astonishing. It was Havdalah time when I made the Bari B'samim, and I passed the B'samim around, and I watched that someone handed the B'samim to the Kala. She wouldn't smell it. She first handed it to the Chassan. Only after he smelled it would she smell it. I was impressed. Then after I made Havdalah, I took them into my office, and I was speaking to both of them. And then after a while, I asked him to step outside. I wanted to speak to her alone. And we spoke for a few minutes, and then it was time for him to come back in. And when he walked back in the door, she stood up. And I said to myself, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. What she did instinctively and intuitively is exactly what the Rambam defines as the formula for success in a marriage. A man has to respect his wife. Mechabdo yosu migufo, respect her more than himself. Ve'ovo kugufo, and love her like herself. And a wife has to treat her husband with exceeding honor. She was brought up in a fine Beis Yaakov. She went to a fine seminary. She was taught, you treat your husband with honor. After all, he's probably a Talmud Chacham by now. He's been learning many years in yeshiva. My husband. So she stood up. And what I shared with them at that point was a concept that I only really began understanding of late. You see, Hashem wants marriages to succeed. And if you'd like to know what the great gift of infatuation is, it's not that magic, because I guarantee the magic passes. That wondrous feeling, the neurotransmitters in your brain going off, that will pass. But if you'd like to know what the chassan and kala period, that period of infatuation, really trained you in, it trained you in the right mode of behavior. By instinct, by nature, you act the right way. He respects her, she respects him. They act in a way that they're supposed to. And the key, one of the keys to success in a marriage is to maintain the behaviors even when the feelings wane. You see, the magic will pass. The goal is, when the magic passes, to begin building the real bond of love, the real attachment that's far deeper and far more significant. But there definitely will be a period when the magic passes and the relationship yet is not at that point. To build real bonds of love, to build that real sense, requires a lot of time. And the magic will pass long before the real love, the real connection will come in. And one of the keys to success in a marriage is learn the behaviors when you're chassan and kala. That respect, that care, the regard, you learn the way to act. The magic will teach you how to act. And when the magic passes, you keep acting that way. And as long as you use the system the way Hashem designed it, the love will come, the attachment will come, and then that again will bring back the behaviors. You see, what she instinctively did was treat her husband with tremendous respect. The women's lib movement would have a tremendous problem with what she did. Oh my goodness, what are you, subservient? What are you, a slave? She's certainly not a slave. And he, if he's not a fool, will treat her with equal respect. But when a couple treat each other with that kind of respect, and they share with each other, that's the first outside ingredient for building the attachment. Then they have to do the necessary work. They have to maintain the romantic connection. The courtship has to continue. They have to build a real connection by communicating, by sharing, by being in each other's life. But the respect and the outside pieces are so critical. What the world at large has lost is a sense of respect, a sense of propriety. When they lost gender differentiations, when they began mixing that men are women and women are men, and why can't a woman be a fireman? It wasn't just that they mixed up the roles. They totally misunderstood the nature of a human being. A woman was given a certain nature because Hashem wants her to fill a certain role, and a man was given a certain nature because that's what Hashem wants him to do. When each of them does their part, within themselves they're satisfied, they're happy. And within a marriage, they have to recognize that their differences will come out. He has different needs, she has different needs. If the couple as a unit are open-eyed and they're paying attention to each other's needs and they're listening without the dismissive, ah, it's a girl, that's a guy, blah. But they're open-minded and learning and listening, they become attentive to each other, they become connected, they share things, and they build the bond of love. May Hashem grant us the wisdom, open-mindedness, and ability to put this step into practice.